la religion. Ma propre parole.
Welcome to You, Me, Empathy. Thank you for listening. We would like to remind you that this podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Known as just a silly boy with a feely heart. Please consider supporting the show. Check us out on Patreon or simply leave a review on iTunes. Here's your host and creator of the show, Known Wells.
Greetings, empathy heroes. Welcome to You, Me, Empathy. My name is Known Wells, and I am the creator of the show. Thanks for being here. I appreciate you. I appreciate that you are here with an open heart and an open mind and maybe an open beverage of some kind. And that rhymed, and that makes me happy. Also, I am so thankful that You, Me, Empathy has this community of beautiful humans who are courageous in their openness, talking about mental health and normalizing those conversations in our various human groups, relationships, friends, etc. It's what we need. It's what the world needs. So thanks for doing that. I appreciate that so much. This is really what the podcast is all about, normalizing those conversations, giving people the opportunity to talk about their struggles and their mental health journeys. And today on the show, on episode 29, I have Sherry Heller, who is a clinical social worker, a psychotherapist, and an interfaith minister. Sherry and I explore narcissistic fathers. This is something Sherry and I both have in common. And Sherry helps us define narcissism in this episode. We explore where narcissism originates and its impact on relationships, love, the world at large, and how we can better understand and combat narcissism in our lives. Sherry has a pretty heartbreaking story, and she's done some amazing work in the world and is doing amazing work in the world in her writing, in her social work, in her interfaith ministry. She's very empowering and a very inspiring woman. And I was just grateful to have her on the show to tell her story. And I think you guys will love it. There is a trigger warning. There's some conversations about sexual abuse, addiction, and violence. They're all mentioned in this episode. So that is the trigger warning for you. Before we get into the episode, I want to remind you that You, Me, Empathy is on Instagram and Twitter at You, Me, Empathy. Please, if you're on those platforms, give us a follow. I'm a bit more active, I think, on Instagram, but please give us a follow on both. We also have a Facebook community, so go check that out. That's at facebook.com/groups/YouMeEmpathy, and a Facebook page, facebook.com/YouMeEmpathy. And we're on Patreon, patreon.com/YouMeEmpathy. It's a place to go to support the show on an ongoing basis. It's like a subscription model. You pay monthly, and you could pay as little as 25 cents an episode to support me and this podcast. Another free way to support the show is to leave a joyful rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Wouldn't that be nice? And sometimes I read them on the show, so you can hear your name coming out of my face. Okay, enjoy this episode. Thanks for being here, guys, on episode 29 of You, Me, Empathy with Sherry Heller on narcissistic fathers.
La 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 la, you, 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 you,
Empathy, a podcast about exploring the struggles we face in our day-to-day lives as humans trying to get by on this wondrous and overwhelming pale blue dot. The intent of You Me Empathy is to talk openly, without judgment, about our neuroses, our mental illnesses, our shared anxieties and worries, to create a dialogue that is vulnerable and deeply human and empathetic, and to share that dialogue with others to inspire emotional and cognitive collaboration and insight so we can, hand in hand, break down the stigma that makes us feel shame and guilt for struggling, for feeling our feelings, for being human. You Me Empathy is a safe, friendly space designed to inspire the beauty in each of us. Today, I'm excited and, I admit, a little nervous to journey to empathy land again on the topic of narcissistic fathers with psychodynamic therapist, interfaith minister, playwright, and freelance writer, Sherry Heller. Hello, Sherry.
Hey, how are you, Nan?
I'm doing very well. I'm so honored and excited to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Of course, of course.
And yeah. I share your nervousness in this topic, so you are not alone.
Well, thank you. We need to hear that you are not alone from time to time, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's critical.
It is. It is. It's precisely why this podcast exists, to remind my listeners that we are in this together. Yeah. Well, before we get into you and your story and the topic of narcissistic fathers, let's do a check-in. How are you doing today? How was your week, Sherry?
Well, my week was great. I went to Austin to see the MotoGP Circuit of the Americas and Marquez won, and it was a fabulous race. And the people in Austin and San Antonio were so warm and gracious, very authentic. It was a great reprieve from New York, which can be very ruthless at times. And I came back and somehow my shoulder got into this wonky place, but I guess that's part of readjusting. So I'm kind of recalibrating, okay. You know, and getting ready to go back into the grind of everyday life. So I'm having a pretty mellow day. Okay. And that was a great week. I love to travel, and it was a wonderful trip.
That's good to hear. What is this race? I don't know anything about this.
It's an international motorcycle race. I got turned on to motorcycle racing through my partner. He loves motorcycles. We actually took a 1,500-mile trip many years ago throughout the Southwest. And I view the race sometimes on TV, so seeing it in person was unbelievable because the skill involved is just off the charts. And it was very exciting. There's a huge fan base. People came from all over the world to see the race. And yeah, it was wonderful.
Is it like on a track or is it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So Circuit of the Americas is a huge track. So I guess there are about 20 competitors at top motorcycle riders from around the world, compete. One of the riders who's iconic is Rossi, and, he's from Italy, and they kind of has this ridiculous rivalry going on with Marquez, who is like a god on wheels. He's this young guy from Spain. He's amazing. And Marquez basically blew everyone out of the water. I mean, he took the lead right from the get-go, even though there were these sanctions imposed on him. So, you know, there's that whole ridiculous kind of celebrity drama that goes on around it. And just kind of amusing. But the race itself is just, it's very riveting to watch.
Nice.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've never really gotten into watching racing of any kind, really. But there was a brief period when I was studying abroad in Swansea, Wales, in college, my sophomore year in college, where I had a flatmate who was from Finland, and he loved Formula One racing.
And
so I remember watching a few races with him and sort of being enthralled a little bit by his sort of vigor and excitement for that race.
Yeah, the Formula One is also takes place at Circuit of the Americas. And that's a really upscale race.
Yeah.
You know, because you're, that's on another level.
Yeah.
A little more down home with the motorcycle racing, but that's exciting too. I don't quite get into the auto racing, but the motorcycle racing I find compelling. Maybe because I just, it amazes me how the guys become one with the bike and they're going 200 miles an hour. I mean, it's pretty remarkable to watch.
Yeah. That's terrifies me.
It is terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always worry when my partner Octavio, when he rides and, because you never know. I mean, especially riding in New York, people are not always that friendly on the road.
Right.
So, but it is wonderful. I mean, when I would be a passenger on the bike, it just is a level of freedom that is really just compelling.
Yeah.
And beautiful.
I could see that. Well, thanks for sharing that, Sherry. I appreciate it. As for me, my check-in this week, I was having a yesterday. In fact, as of this recording, I was just having a low day. I was just feeling very low energy, low emotionally, and when you're having those days, it makes it a little harder to get through the days. But toward the end of the day, Jessica, my wife, we went to a local comic shop because we got a gift certificate and we're big comic book fans, just readers in general. But in the car, she said, I have a little gift for you. And I said, what? No, I don't deserve that. And it took me some time to kind of like muster the energy or excitement for even a gift or to receive a gift. You know, I was in such a state, I guess. And I open up the gift, and it's a little enamel pin. It's a pin that says, I have it in front of me here. It's like a blue ribbon, and it says, "I talk to people today, yay!" And on the sort of pin backing, it says the Introvert Award. And it was just kind of a good, because earlier that day, I work from home, and so I spent a few hours at the coffee shop with Jessica and a couple of her friends, and I did, in fact, talk to people. So, I don't know. It's just nice to get that validation from her, and it's just a good reminder that, like, oh, you know, she is paying attention, and she does care about me, and I do know, and she knows that getting out and getting face-to-face time with actual humans from time to time is good for me, even though sometimes it is a struggle, so... That was, a low day turned a little brighter from a little gift from Jessica. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, it was nice. Mm-hmm. Well, Sherry, I want to. So, the listener should know. I have many questions, but I want to kind of start with a little bit of your. Can you give just a little sort of brief, however brief you want it, synopsis of your childhood, I guess. Mm-hmm. So there's lots there, and you've written about it beautifully.
Yeah.
And we'll link all of that stuff in the show notes. But I wanna kind of set the scene before we get into talking about narcissistic fathers and narcissism and stuff, and maybe explore a little bit of your childhood. And I have questions about, the schizophrenia you experience with your mother and that sort of scene. Can you maybe just start a little bit at the childhood, some sort of seminal moments you want to share?
Okay. The reason why I wanted to really talk about narcissistic fathers, well, I read your piece, which is very beautiful and profound. And But so much of the emphasis in my childhood revolved around my mother's schizophrenia and the repercussions of her illness on my development, when in fact my father was very, very much an abuser in my life. So early on, from what I know, I was born while my mother was floridly psychotic and was hospitalized. So I wasn't able to really bond with my mother from the get-go. And I have an older sister who's 7 years older. I think by the time my sister was five, she found her mother. Our mother attempted suicide. My father was always very peripheral. He was a journalist. He started out in journalism. He was never home. He was also a sex addict. He was always unfaithful. So my sister was the room to be the caregiver. She found her mother. I was born 2 years later. Against the advice of a psychiatrist, they decided to have another child, which was me. So I was born into a pretty bad situation. My mother, when we lived in Queens in Rochdale Village, things really escalated. My mother was very floridly psychotic. I guess I was about three at that point. She was very violent, walked around with a knife in her purse. She kicked our father out of the house. We were living in complete squalor. We were starving. Both my sister and I were malnourished, and I had an impacted rectum that I almost died from. So my mother also would keep us hostage in the house. And sometimes if she would go out, my sister and I would sneak out of the house just to be around people. So I was a selective mute. I wasn't socialized. Almost like a feral child in a way. But ironically, I had all these books. My father left behind all these books, and I loved reading, and my sister loved reading and music. So it was this very strange juxtaposition of this very creative internal world and the squalor and the tragedy that I was grappling with as a little girl. And when we would sneak out, we would go to a park, and that was very difficult for me. We would come back. My mother would beat my sister. We weren't allowed to leave the house. And it was extremely bleak. It was a very dark situation. At one point, we were sleeping in the park. My mother believed the house was on fire because there was a sign about a fire sale. Eventually, she was to PC'd. I think she was going to take my sister and I away to Canada. My mother's Canadian.
She was to PC'd? What was
it? To PC'd means that you could, two court-appointed psychiatrists can involuntarily hospitalize someone.
Okay.
So my father and his family went through the courts. My sister and I were to be made wards of state, which means we would have been put through the foster care system. But relatives on my father's side of the family, who I never met before, came forward and took custodial responsibility for my sister and I.
How old were you at that age? How old were you?
Three going on four.
Okay.
And so I lived with my grandmother, and my sister lived with my aunt and uncle, who was also in Brooklyn. And my mother was hospitalized for a very extended period of time. And I did start to heal with my grandmother. I love my grandmother. All my grandparents are from Russia. And I really loved my grandmother's cooking. And they were Orthodox Jews. And I remember doing the bracha at the candles with my grandmother, the prayers. And I remember loving dogs, and she had these friends who had a dog, Queenie, who I really loved, and I would go visit Queenie. And I was starting to become dropped into my body because I was very frozen. Mm-hmm. I remember kids in the building throwing a ball at me, and I just let it bounce off my body. I was really in shock. I was very, very traumatized. So I was very close with my sister, and I don't think either one of us would have made it through without each other.
Right.
And My father was always remote. He would come bring me books. He sort of had this larger in life quality to me because he was so esoteric and unavailable. He became godlike to me in a way. And he was an artist, and I loved watching him paint. And he was brilliant, and he loved to advertise that, to broadcast that. So he was the quintessential narcissist in the sense that he needed a lot of attention, and my sister and I became a source of supply for him in different ways. And, you know, given his mental illness, my mother's mental illness, they had this delusional idea that we would be a happy family. Once again, she came out of the hospital, which was, of course, nuts. And
so when did she, just to set the timeline here, you were living with relatives of your father's side. And then when did you get back into the house, back home with your father and your mother?
So I think we reconvened as a family. I guess I was about 5 and a half.
Okay, so you had like a year or so with your relatives?
Yeah, definitely more than a year. And at that point, things again decompensated and became increasingly violent. I always had a love of animals, so... And my sister and I would have hamsters that we named after Desmond from Obladi Oblada from the Beatles, because we love the Beatles.
Nice.
And we had Desmond 1, Desmond 2, Desmond 3. It's like a legacy of Desmonds. And so there were vestiges of beauty that we latched onto in that way. And I remember you mentioned loving comic books. I remember writing a comic book as a little girl. My sister was very fluent with languages, and we found ways, I think, to feed our emptiness, that insatiability.
Yeah.
But we were a wreck, you know. I had to sometimes periodically fight with my mother to get out of the house throughout the years. I started just leaving the house and hanging out till 3 a.m. in my teenage years, putting myself in very violent situations, reckless situations. My sister and I both used drugs and alcohol to just kind of medicate and really to emotionally regulate ourselves.
Right.
Because we were very flooded and also very dissociated. So with my dad, I mean, he would come and go, you know, and there were times when we would be hungry. We had a lot of eviction notices. My father was the only one who was working. And, you know, he really initiated Stockholm syndrome, and that we would be hungry. And then I would go meet him on a street corner. He would pick me up with one of his girlfriends, his many girlfriends, take me to a bar and buy me a hamburger, and he became deified, you know, because
so
when you're hungry
live,
and someone...
He didn't live with your mother anymore?
No, because she was coming at him with knives and hammers.
Uh-huh.
This is the kind of environment that ensued because there was so much volatility between them. And frankly, he was very provocative, but the onus was on my mother. For being so floridly insane and vitriolic. But in fact, my father could really gaslight and covertly create situations where my mother was triggered. And he mocked her. He everything was a joke. He was very into sadistic humor. And in fact, at one point when I started my treatment process, I kind of bottomed out, I guess about 18, and was in a very bad way. And I catapulted myself into registering for college, and was working 3 jobs to pay my tuition, to pay for housing. And I started therapy And I really started seeing my father for who he was. And I remember having to, he did at some point come into therapy, which was very bizarre. And my therapist was really blown away by him because he was laughing at me. Yeah. Because, well, my therapist was my witness, my ally, and my father was laughing at me in the session. So I was crying.
Wow.
And yeah, he was really a malignant, sadistic person. And I was crying and I said, "You never loved me." It's interesting feeling that now because I've really blocked it.
Yeah.
And he laughed. And he said, try to get my therapist to align with him. And said, you believe her. Like, I'm nuts, just like he would do with my mother. It was very debasing. It was very humiliating. But I was groomed to believe that debasement was virtuous. You know, it's very, very difficult to break out of being an object. And it's a very intense indoctrination, very intense form of brainwashing, especially when you have a parent who is the designated problem.
Right.
You know, so the narcissist seems to be the competent one.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, but the lack of inhumanity is startling. And it followed me throughout my life in terms of people I selected. I was petrified of dating. I mean, as a young girl, I mean, because my father was a sex addict and he was addicted to porn. And he exposed me to pornography. I mean, he would leave books for me to read that were really all about rape. And I was petrified.
Early on? How early?
Early on, like 5 years old, 6 years old.
Wow.
And then, yeah. Yeah, no, I identify that as sexual abuse.
Absolutely.
And taking me to bars also was a form of sexual abuse. Leaving out pictures of graphic sexual acts when I was a teenager, when I would go to see him. It was really insidious. And so I didn't have a capacity to relate to boys who might have been interested in me. In fact, I gravitated as I got older to men like my father, more refined versions, perhaps. And that was the most painful and difficult pattern to break out of. To finally, and I had to just completely remove myself from being involved with anyone for many years so that I could reengage in a way that was healthy.
Oh,
and that's when, yeah.
I can so relate to that. You know, I just wanted to say, I'm sorry. And I also can so relate to that, that feeling of, you know, on one side you have your mother who's like very outwardly, outwardly dangerous, right? You have clear signs of, you know, of ways to avoid her, knives and that stuff. And then, you know, it's no wonder sort of going to your father, who's a little bit more sort of, that stuff's a little bit more hidden, which, you know, can be even more damaging, you know.
Very confusing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, it's no wonder that, you know, you were getting some love, right, through him, and then feeling later that, okay, is this the type of person I want in my life? Like, I definitely had those questions with my father, and I had to get to a point where I had to make that cut because I felt trapped in a way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't refer to it as love, what my father was giving me. I don't think my father was capable of love.
Okay.
I feel that and that was part of the distortion. I saw it as love. In fact, the irony is my mother had more humanity than my father. I mean, there were times my mother would take me to an acting class. And again, I would have these, just these desires that I would want to act on. I thought acting would be something that would be riveting for me. It would be, it would connect me to people. I thought it would be fun. My mother took me to an acting school and I loved it. I really loved it. And my father took it away from me, you know, and that was his MO. He could give something to me and then he would take it away. Individuation was completely taboo. So any sign of my actualizing myself would be met with scorn, would be met with shaming. And for me to individuate, you know, as an artist, as an actor, to flourish in that way was a threat, because then I couldn't be controlled.
Right.
You know, I was there to be an extension, a narcissistic extension. That was my function.
That's a classic relationship of the narcissistic parent and this daughter or son.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how, let's get into that, the narcissistic aspect of this. You know, as someone who works in the field, I'm curious, like, how, let's start with how we define narcissism.
Okay. There is a, it falls within what's called cluster B pathology, which are just diagnostic traits that typify certain types of character disorders. Narcissists, I guess the hallmark of narcissism is an absence of empathy. Obviously, from a developmental perspective, the narcissist is very stunted. They don't really have frustration tolerance. The judgment may be off. They're addicted to attention. There's an inflated grandiosity that obscures deep-seated self-hatred and feelings of inadequacy. And they're dangerous. They're dangerous because they don't really have a moral compass. They can mimic emotions, but they don't necessarily feel deeply. And they take different forms. So there are some narcissists can rage and be more blatantly outrageous. There are others who are more of the garden variety narcissists who could be very charming. There's a spectrum, you know, and on the end of the spectrum of narcissism is psychopathology. And that's the most extreme version of the narcissist. A lot of people have traits. And of course, you know, it's important to have healthy narcissism. That's a foundation of self-esteem and self-regard. I'd say, you know, my father was a pretty malignant narcissist, but he also was covert in a lot of ways. But I think there were also concurrent mental illnesses that he dealt with. But narcissists don't engage in treatment. They really can't form that kind of bond. They're not able to humble themselves, to really examine themselves. So if I work with people who have narcissistic traits, as opposed to narcissistic disorder, they exhibit the capacity to examine who they are. There has to be some degree of humility and the capacity to form a relationship in order to even avail themselves of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So someone with the full-blown disorder wouldn't be able to benefit from treatment, in my opinion.
Yeah. Where, you know, as someone who, you know, my father's a narcissist, I will say that. And, you know, there were many years where I wanted to understand why he was doing the things he was doing, why he was acting the way he was, saying the things he did. But is that a futile effort, you know, to understand where narcissism comes from?
I don't think it's a futile effort. I think, though, unlike people who are not narcissists who also present with histories of complex trauma, the narcissist is missing the capacity to feel empathically connected. And so, I mean, and having, because I work extensively with people with complex trauma, and I've heard some of the most unbelievably heinous stories of abuse, it's very clear to me that constitutionally, you know, one's history, the environment, the circumstances are not, do not predict causation, do not are not absolute, right, in terms of saying that a person will become narcissistically driven. A person's humanity, I think, is something inherent. And I think narcissists lack a fundamental sense of humanity, people who are really malignant. And so you can understand, sure, it could be helpful in terms of understanding yourself, where your father comes from, but that doesn't exonerate him. And it doesn't necessarily explain the choices that he made as a human being.
Right.
You know, you were his son. And I have, believe me, I have many, many men that I work with who were tragically abused as children who are loving fathers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's important, I think, to really suss out the person from the pathology, from the illness, to see, you know, irrespective of what your father may have endured, there is something broken in him that compelled him to operate the way he did. And that's how I view it with my father as well.
When did you realize that? Like, when did you... You mentioned, you know, when you're a teenager, 18, maybe you said you first went to therapy. Is, you know, in therapies, was that where you started kind of figuring out, like, oh, my father's a narcissist, or did that come earlier or later?
I didn't, that, it came much later, actually. I realized that I had unbelievable rage towards my father that started to be awakened in therapy, and I worked with a man. My first therapist was a man I worked with for 10 years who was just like the father I never had. And that really awakened in me realizations about my father that were very shattering. But I, the whole premise of really understanding the futility in trying to access something from the narcissist that just isn't there, I don't think that was awakened for me until much later in life, when I began to realize that narcissists are different than the regular population. I don't know how else to put it. I mean, I see them almost as like kind of pod people. I mean, there are people who are soulless. There are people who are not accessible. And no amount of love or insight or understanding is going to change that. And so that was, you know, when it really came up for me, ironically, was when I went to seminary in 2004. And I was on this whole forgiveness fantasy and on the heels of having broken up with yet another narcissist and bewildered, but he seemed so together, you know, because often they could just, you know, they seem so altruistic, even benevolent, you know, in, and that could be a different form of supply. That threw me into really understanding narcissism. And it was funny because I was in this, what Judith Herman, who wrote Trauma and Recovery, she refers to as the forgiveness fantasy. And she also talks about the compensation fantasy. And when I would do my spiritual practice, I would just have all this rage come up. And then all this information started coming up about my father. And I ran into this woman in seminary who I knew from high school. And she was friends with a girl I was friends with. And she told me the story that this girl had borrowed a pair of pants for me. And I remember that she brought it to my father's house and he did something to her. He traumatized her, probably exposed himself to her, called her brown sugar, something like that. And she wouldn't get into it, but he did something really despicable. And I went into a rage and my whole spiritual practice was all about going deeper into the darkness. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was organically led. And then I realized I have to confront this. You know, I can't do a spiritual bypass here and just try to deny the hatred and the rage that I feel. I have to assimilate this. I have to respect my humanity. And then I started just doing so much research about what narcissism is. That was pivotal for me. And I really think it helped me tremendously in my healing process and also as a therapist.
Yeah.
You know, because so many clients who come to me say no one believes them, you know, and they find it hard to believe themselves. How could someone, you know, fuck with you so relentlessly with absolutely no compunction and no remorse? And it's like, well, they're a narcissist.
They're master manipulators.
That's how, and they don't care. They're sadistic and they enjoy toying with you and gaslighting you and having control because narcissists love domination. And that's why I feel I could never say my father loved me because domination and love really can't coexist.
Mm-hmm.
So,
can you give me some? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I was just gonna ask. Can you give me like maybe a couple more snapshots of your relationship with your father as a child or a teenager, or even as a young adult that exemplify or sort of showcase this narcissism?
Mm-hmm. Okay. When I traveled, I think a friend of mine, I couch surfed a lot as a kid. So I was very lucky to have friends whose parents opened their home to me. And one friend, her mother would buy me tickets to the ballet. I love the ballet. And when I was a teenager, and I would stay at their house a lot. And I've been working since I was 12, and I saved money to go to Scandinavia with my friend. I think I was about 18 or 17, and travel was much cheaper back then. There was this wonderful organization, Alumni International, and we booked a 3-week trip, and I bought this beautiful urn for my father. I took all these pictures, and all he did, he would mock everything. Everything that I would show him, the gift I gave him, he said there were better ones. They have nicer ones in Germany. Everything was cutting. Everything was a put down. So I became ashamed of my wanderlust, my love for travel. I wanted to share it with him. It became clear that I was to be the audience. I was not to shine. His taking away acting for me was the epitome of how he would maneuver. When I was in college and I met with him for dinner and I was completely self-sufficient and supporting myself, we sat there in a restaurant and he was just blathering on about himself. And I said, Dad, do you want to know anything about my life? Do you want to hear about school, college, the work I'm doing? And he's like, oh, yeah. You know, and I got my 5 minutes. And that was pretty much the dynamic.
Yeah.
I was there to cater to his needs. I was also, there was a time he loved to go fishing and I would go fishing with him. And that was when I was pretty young. I had a friend I guess we were about 13 or 14. We went fishing with him. And because he never did anything by the book, this is another interesting side to him. He had a lot of mafia ties. He was the accountant for a bar that was mafia run, and a lot of his friends were hitmen. So Whoa. That was really, oh yeah. The, wow. And so I met like Louis Pizza and Joey Bull. It was bizarre. But he had this front. He was an accountant. He was unable to make a living as a journalist, and then he went into accounting. So he didn't have a license because he had so many traffic violations, and he just let everything lapse. So he's driving without a license, and we got into a car accident. So my friend, who was 15, just got her driver's permit, and he wants her to get into the behind the wheel to take the rap for him.
My goodness.
Oh, yeah. And I can't believe that I had the consciousness, you know, the instinctual awareness to say, that is nuts, Dad. She's not going to do that for you. And she was not going to do it anyway, but I was outraged. And then he and my sister really went into the smear campaign where I was a terrible daughter, which I always was the terrible daughter, because I didn't give him money when he asked for it. I didn't support him in exploiting my friend. I called him out on stuff. So that made me a terrible human being.
Hmm.
And, but nevertheless, I mean, I also doubted myself. So I had these moments of realization where I stood up for myself, but I carried the shame of feeling that I was a bad person.
Right.
And, you know, and that I failed my father and that I wasn't a good daughter.
Hmm. And so heartbreaking. Because, you know, us, when we're young and we have a evolutionary biological drive to establish our independence. And then when we have someone who is a narcissist in our lives, you know, especially as a parent, they're threatened by that independence, and they do what they can to squash it. And then we feel, the shame, as you said, we feel shame, we feel guilt, we question all of it.
Yeah. Well, it's also our biological inheritance to bond, to attach.
Sure.
I was unconditionally dependent on my father and my mother for my survival, regardless of how sick they were.
Right.
And so my individuation process is predicated on their ability to love me. I mean, I had a terrible abandonment panic throughout my life.
Hmm.
And fragmentation. And, you know, relationally, the relational trauma was very severe. And I debased myself. I humiliated myself to get vestiges of what I thought were love. I played out, you know, what Freud called the repetition compulsion. I repetitiously and compulsively enacted these traumatic dynamics with my father in my pursuit of love. And it's very sad that I no longer feel ashamed. I just feel it's a shame. Mm. It's a shame that I went through that. It's a shame that I was driven to act out these wounds.
But, you know, how... I mean, in a way, it's what you had to do, right? You had to survive. You had to get through it.
Yeah, it was an attempt to try to master it. And that's what we're driven to do. And until we're able to confront the truth, which is to demythologize our parents, to see really what they did to us so that we can operate from a different place, a healthier place. And that could take a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that's just going to happen by osmosis. I mean, it's just the level of excavation. I don't even know how I stayed the course sometimes. And I see it with my clients. I mean, it's really grueling. It's grueling work.
But there's hope, right? I mean,
yes, definitely there's hope.
Yeah,
absolutely. I've actualized a lot of my ambitions as a human being, and I feel very positive with the thing that I'm the most gratified by is my ability to share a really meaningful, loving relationship with my partner. And I never thought I would allow someone like him. And he's a very, he also had a narcissistic father. Really, his father was really psychopathic. But he's such a genuinely loving human being. And I feel very blessed. And it's my greatest, many ways, I feel it's my greatest accomplishment just to be able to give and receive love from a mature place that's pure.
That's beautiful.
It is. It is beautiful.
In preparation for this episode, I was thinking about, you know, the ways that my father presented as a narcissist and thinking about, you know, just the sort of classic narcissistic traits, you know, and I definitely the independence as a threat sort of idea was a thing that I dealt with. And I remember there was this one time where, you know, my father had this idea that I think he wanted me, firstborn son, to be like into what he was into. You know, he's like a successful businessman now, and he wanted to, I think, wanted me to be interested in that world, and I just was not at all. I was kind of more in my head and artsy and silly and creative, and he hated that. And I remember at one point he was yelling at me, you should just go work at McDonald's. And I remember thinking about that. I was a teenager. I also had jobs early on. And I remember thinking, even in the moment, thinking that, like, okay, I will. What's wrong with... And I even sensed, in the way he said it, I sensed, oh, McDonald's is less than him. McDonald's is for the poor or what have you. That's like the way he said everything was, I am superior than everyone and everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he had to do what he could to try to boost his sagging ego, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And even if that meant debasing his son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you're right. I mean, there is nothing shameful about working hard,
right?
You know, and getting a job.
Yeah.
I remember selling chipwiches for a living when the World Trade Center was here on Vesey Street, and doing whatever I could to support myself. And I take pride in that. My father also, I mean, when I tried drawing, I emulated his ability, his talents. He made fun of me and I stopped. When I graduated from graduate school, he would say things like, see, she's like me, you know, so is nothing was of my own volition or inherent to myself as a human being apart from him. I was just simply an object, a narcissistic extension.
Yeah.
An object. And if I deviated, from his idea of what I should be, certainly there would be contempt, humiliation, smear campaign, or the, you know, just completely ignoring me.
Yeah.
All kinds of strategies to keep you in line.
Yep. I want to know how your healing process has been in this, and your relationship with your father and your relationship with narcissism in particular. You know, and I'll just share a little anecdote real quick before you answer that, is that for me, I still have quite a bit hard time with narcissism I perceive in even strangers, or even, you know, characters in movies that are narcissists. You know, I have, like, I just have such a, still to this day, a visceral reaction to those traits, and I am hypersensitive to them. And, you know, I'm working on that in therapy and stuff, but I'm curious as for you, how has your healing process been in your relationship with your father and then narcissism?
I pulled away from my father completely at a certain point in my life, because when I tried to negotiate a reasonable dynamic with him, I saw that it was impossible. He was just unable to be a decent human being. And I didn't want to bargain with that. In my life, I didn't feel that it was going to allow me to continue evolving and growing as a person to accommodate that, because we share chromosomes. I couldn't prevail.
Yeah. How old were you when you realized that?
Probably in my 20s.
Okay. Yeah.
And I pulled away because, and I tried. It was absurd. I mean, I would even say to him, I'm going to let you know when you say something that offends me. And it just, like, I was like a freaking parrot. I mean, there wasn't a time when he wasn't offending me.
Right.
So I kept on erecting boundaries. Like, how is this serving me
right.
in a positive way? But the other thing I want to respond to that you said about in terms of the hypersensitivity, I really relate to that, because I don't necessarily think it's something you have to maybe refine it, but, I'm very sensitive to people with schizophrenia. I'm very permeable. I'm also very sensitive to narcissism. When I had a client, and rarely would a narcissist come into therapy, but I had someone mandated through the courts years ago who was a full-on narcissist, pathological liar, sex offender, and I would get sick, physically sick after every session. I felt like my ability to pick up on his malignant energy was so strong that I didn't end up working with him anyway, because he was really not able to engage in treatment. And in fact, when I sent him for group therapy, they said, we're not working with him. He's a psychopath. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that seals the deal for me. So I think being able to be very attuned to pathology is positive, because your instincts are on high alert. And I live most of my life with my disowning my instincts to survive. So I just know what I can be around and what I can't. I do think that at this point in my life, throughout my process in terms of my having to heal from narcissistic dynamics with my father, I had to really examine how I so automatically over-function with people and are overly accommodating.
Oh, I see.
I've pulled back. I've had to look at my interpersonal standards. What do I require of people? I don't want to dumb myself down. I feel like I told myself in the spirit of giving people the benefit of the doubt, or, you know, I do recognize we're flawed as human beings, but there are certain things I don't want to have to tolerate. You know, I want a level of relatedness that is sincere and elevated, and I want to be around people who examine themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to find, you know, it really is. And I hear that from my clients I work with as well, as they become more self-actualized and more attuned to the process of self-realization. They recognize that a lot of the relationships they form just don't accommodate who they're becoming.
I see,
and,
yeah.
So.
That's so important. That's like, I'm realizing that myself, like. I'm very thankful for and grateful for my partner. You know, she's very accepting and open to all of it, and I'm thankful for it, because I'm actually going through a period in my life. you know, and this podcast is part of it, you know, where I was sort of my reaction to my environment growing up was, for many years, just to sort of hide, right? And like protect myself, protect my heart, you know, that sort of thinking. And it definitely impacted my sort of early relationships and in college and young adulthood before, and thankfully, I mean, that it was hard because I didn't know how to really open up my heart.
Yeah.
Cause I was like, it was just, you know, I always described it as like my heart guard, but it was just like such a, it was like deep inside there. And there was like a, you know, sort of intricate moss laden, you know, key that had to open it. And I eventually was able to open it, but it just took a long time because of those experiences.
Yeah. Well, you were repeatedly betrayed.
Right. Right.
You know, yeah, I mean, I was very compulsively driven to try to latch on to people because I didn't have family. I removed myself from the abuse and I was extremely lonely. But at the same time, I revel in my solitude, you know,
right.
And I, on the upside, I think one of the things that I took from, I was working from family systems theory, there's a different terminology for roles that people assume in this system, the family system. And I was the lost child, and the lost child tends to be highly creative and a dreamer, someone who could lose himself in their world to survive. And that I have very able dissociative abilities, and I find that works well for me now because I enjoy my time alone, as is my partner really enjoys his time. He's a musician and he loves his time alone too. And I love writing and anything in the arts, really. I love, you know, the whole creative process, and it allows me to choose at this point in my life people to bring into my orbit who are at a higher level of relatedness.
Yeah.
You know, and I've earned that. I feel, I mean, we all deserve that, but I feel certainly from where I came from, my template for attachment was just mired in abuse and exploitation.
Yeah.
And so I was pulled toward it and I also retreated from it. I was, you know, it was very daunting to break out of that.
But you did. And it's so amazing to hear that you can simultaneously sort of, you know, self-care, you know, and self-love and love yourself and have that independence with your partner. That's so important and so great to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very gratifying to, there's a, what did Fromm say in The Art of Loving? Mature love says, I need you because I love you. And immature love says, I love you because I need you.
Hmm. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Well. Well. What else do we want to talk about in terms of narcissism? Are there sort of things we're missing? I want to give the listeners a good, I mean, I think we've, you know, through your experience and your story about your father, I think we've given a good snapshot of what a narcissist is, but I'm wondering if we're missing anything.
Well, one thing I really want to emphasize, because I think it's inherent to the human condition to want to believe the best in people. And that's where I really got derailed from fully accepting who my father was. This is a pathology in which the narcissist is not someone who is capable of reciprocating any kind of genuine love or compassion. And that's very hard to wrap one's head around.
Yeah.
You know, there are people with narcissistic traits who have, you know, moments of evil, you could say, but are fundamentally at the core able to engage, you know, with humanity. But I do think this is where people get very swept up in the cycle with the narcissist, because they keep looking for something that's not there. And it's like, to me, when I first really started to shatter these illusions, I'm like, this is science fiction. I mean, this is really inconceivable.
Yeah.
I'm at a place now where I accept it and I understand, you know, it for what it is, but we have to be willing to look at the dark side of the human condition. And to, if we're going for people who are victimized by narcissists, I mean, we see it on a global scale. And I've written about this in terms of, you know, the Vatican or psychopathic leaders, people who are lauded, or what's happening in the celebrity world, people with narcissistic pathology who are lauded and who obscure, you know, these diabolical agendas and motives,
mm-hmm.
because they operate on our inherent need to believe, no, the world is a safe place, life is predictable and stable, and anything that deviates from them is not going to intrude on my consciousness, because that's too scary. And we have to be willing to really see things and to face that fear if we're ever going to really shed light on the narcissist and see the narcissist for who they are.
How do we develop that framework to sort of view the world? Because, I mean, is it about not looking at everyone, you know, seeing the best in everyone? Or is it about just developing the right tools to better suss out people?
I think it's all of that. And I think we need to be willing to be brave enough to get off a sinking ship, to see when, I mean, a lot of people scoff at the notion of evil, for instance, want to believe that, everything has necessarily an environmental basis, which is something, you know, you had raised in terms of understanding your father's history.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, I don't see that, because I think that we're all born constitutionally with certain traits. We're predisposed with certain proclivities, you know, and personalities. And there are people, we need to be willing to kind of reframe the way we see life and each other. You know, that some people simply do not have the inherent capacity,
mm-hmm.
you know, to do the right thing. I mean, this is what happens with, I mean, I've written about, you know, the whole sex abuse scandal with the Vatican, and yet how in spite of, you know, decades of supporting Hitler and Mussolini and democide and genocide and sexual abuse, people still uphold notions of papal infallibility, you know, and moral superiority.
Right.
You know, so I think the ability to really be courageous enough to deal with disillusionment and to break out of magical thinking, you know, it requires an adult ego. It requires us to, you know, from a more biblical sense, to leave Eden, mm-hmm. and to eat from the apple, you know, of consciousness, and to wake up, to see things as they really are, not how we want them to be.
Right. That's so well said. It is so often we do view the world the way that we want because it fits. It's easier, right? It's easier. It is hard to accept the fact that we have people in our lives. We're raised by people who are narcissists or aren't good for us. It's hard to accept that, but you know, it is ultimately a more self-actualizing, healing way to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how can we really differentiate inhumanity from humanity? You know, if we are not able to see darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just well, that's keeps very it well. Very muddled.
Yeah. Well, that's very well said, and thank you for sharing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, I think that's a good place to start wrapping it up. I just wanted to share with you, Sherry, that I very much appreciate you and what you're doing, and I will link you know, your stories and your writings in the show notes because I think they're must reads and really powerful.
Thank you, Nan.
Oh, you're welcome. And let's kind of wrap up before we, you know, plug anything you want to plug. Let's talk about our empathy heroes. This is the part of the show where we talk about someone in our lives or someone even from fiction that mm-hmm. is a good empathy hero. Do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
You go first.
Okay.
I have to think about it.
Yeah, no worries. So this may be a little silly one, so be patient, listeners, but Alien Day, which was on April 26th, just a couple of days ago as of this recording, Alien Day obviously is a LV-426 was the ship with which Ellen Ripley was on in the original Alien from 1979. I am a film nerd. Just deal with it. I am calling out Ellen Ripley, or Sigourney Weaver's character, as an empathy hero. Not only was she a strong, independent, fierce individual, but she also loved animals, cats in particular, and she also, you know, wanted to do her part and save her partners, her teammates, her crew. And so if you guys haven't seen the original Alien from 1979, you're missing out because it's an amazing mm-hmm. piece of fiction.
Yeah.
And so yes. Ellen Ripley is my empathy hero this week.
Wonderful. That's a great one.
Thanks.
So, I mean, I have a lot of different people percolating in my head, but I'm thinking of, there was a topical songwriter that I used to love, Phil Oakes.
Oh, yeah.
And he committed suicide when I was 14. And I remember how I wept. And it's strange, but I guess also because my sister loved him and I loved his music. He was part of the Yippies, you know, with Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, Chicago 7. And he was an activist. And activism, I think, ignited the social worker in me. You know, although it wasn't formulated at that age, at that time in my life. But I loved his artistry and I loved his passion and his humor and his convictions, his work with Allende in Chile. Unfortunately, he was a shattered idealist and he also had bipolar disorder and he ended up taking his life. And there was a lot going on in terms of what was happening in the government. But I think he galvanized in me just a sense of righteous indignation about justice and fighting for the underdog. And he was one of my heroes.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. that's a first, Phil Oakes. That's a first empathy hero. So thank you for sharing that.
Oh, so happy to share that. You meant a lot to me.
Yeah, of course. I'm eager to go look him up and learn more about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was an amazing man.
Well, Sherry, as we wrap up, where can people connect with you online, read your work, anything you want to plug? Just this is the time to do it.
Okay. Please feel free to visit my website, sheritherapist.com. That's sheritherapist.com. And I put together an anthology of articles called A Clinician's Journey Clinician's Journey from Complex Trauma to Reclamation. And that can be viewed on Kindle or in hardcover through Amazon and sundry other bookstores, if anyone is interested in reading about complex trauma and thriving.
Awesome.
And yeah.
Well, thank you again for being on Yumi Empathy, Sheri. I appreciate you reaching out to me, and appreciate you sharing and being vulnerable and just sharing your story.
Thank you, Nan, and thank you for sharing as well, and for being such a gracious host. Oh. Really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm happy to be. And to you listeners, as I always say, I'm here, you're here, we're here together on this wayward, overwhelming, awe-inspiring pale blue dot. We have each other. It's you, me, empathy.